We're getting early glimpses of the damage caused by Hurricane Dorian in the Bahamas.
Just flood, 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 flood. We had people in homes, some people who drowned hiding in their attics. The water just kept rising and rising.
Now comes the rescue effort for a devastated island nation. Also today, you've heard the phrase, "I didn't leave my party left me." For a large group of conservatives in the UK, their party has actually kicked them out. And are you in the market for a new job? If you're a man on the shorter side, speak some French, and willing to relocate to a remote island, there's a gig for you.
So we've been looking for somebody who is obviously interested in Napoleon, somebody who fits the suit, obviously.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The aerial footage we're now seeing from the Bahamas is astonishing.
That's the mud.
Desperate residents stranded on rooftops, homes, hospitals, other public buildings, and an airport underwater. Entire neighborhoods that look like they've been put through a wood chipper. Hurricane Dorian is one of the most powerful storms ever recorded in the Atlantic. The Prime Minister of the Bahamas, Hubert Minnis, said some parts of his country have been decimated. Communications are also down throughout much of the Bahamas. We spoke with Eddie Wan 2 days ago. On Monday, he told us that he hadn't heard from his family, including his 12-year-old daughter in Abaco, one of the islands hardest hit by Hurricane Dorian. We managed to get through to Eddie again today through his WhatsApp account. He's the chairman of the Bahamas Air and Sea Rescue Association in Grand Bahama. I asked him if he's been in touch with his loved ones.
I have heard just through the grapevine that they are okay, but as far as physically talking to anybody, no, I have not.
All right. Well, we'll keep our hopes for them up. We also know that Grand Bahama, just in terms of infrastructure and damage, was one of the hardest hit islands in the Bahamas. What are you seeing today? Hi, Eddie. Are you there?
Hello?
Hi, Eddie. It's Marco again. I think we just got cut off.
Yes. Yeah, the WhatsApp is hit and miss.
That's okay. We'll keep going until we get as many questions as we can ask. In terms of just sheer damage to the islands, you're in Grand Bahama. It was hit pretty hard. What have you been seeing today?
Not total destruction, but probably 80% of the flood was our biggest concern, which is our biggest problem as well. Just flood, 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 flood. We had people in homes, some people who drowned hiding in their attics. And we're talking about two-story buildings in some cases, that the water just kept rising and rising. People were 8-10 foot ceilings in their homes or in the attics, and the water just came up in certain areas. I mean, beyond, I can't really talk about it without getting choked up for the most part, but the Basra side of me, you know, you have to work and you have to do what you have to do, but the human part of me is devastated. My sister in Abaco lost her home, my nephew lost their home, and his family. My daughter, again, I haven't spoken with her. Every time I think about her, as you just mentioned her name or talk about her, it's choking me up until I can hear her voice or at least talk to her on WhatsApp or some sort of communication of any sort whatsoever, I'd be happy with. But right now I'm running around. You caught me right now walking into what we call this command emergency center, because I'll obviously be in Basra. I'm going to meet with the minister of Grand Bahama, Mr. Crazy Thompson, Don Cornish, our island administrator, and several other people right now in the government to try and formulate what we're going to do, how we're going to do it, how we're going to get some food supplies over here. How are we going to feed a lot of people who've lost their homes? They've lost primarily everything they had other than what they're wearing. It's a bad case here in Grand Bahama, and I can only just imagine Abaco, because they're 50 times worse than us.
Well, let's start with the very basics, and that's just rescuing people who have survived the storm. I mean, I know on Monday you were trying to get people out, but, I mean, did the storm mean that you had to suspend rescue operations?
We did when it became impossible and probable to do it without risking other human life, the rescuers, to rescue people. Then, yes, we had to hold off and stand down for a couple hours here and a couple hours there. But virtually we're out there at times we should not have been out there. The winds were 160, 180. Gusting, we had some 190s, even case we've got recorded of 200. When we were down around 100 miles an hour, we went out. We went out in Cat 2.
All right. That's okay. He's going great.
Okay, here we go again.
Yeah.
I'm gonna try and stand somewhere that's good.
That's okay. You were saying, Eddie, that you had had to stop rescue operations for an hour or two here and there, but you were saying that you had to continue.
Yes, we continued around 100 mile an hour. We did what we could do right up till dark last night. This morning is primarily the water has subsided. Most of it's gone for the most part, and we are rescuing people who are, but it's not a kind of search and rescue now. It's just going out and grabbing them because the water has subsided quite a bit. I mean, almost gone, you know, but now we're looking at the reality of what actually happened afterwards.
As you head into this meeting, Eddie, with officials in Grand Bahama, what is the plan? I mean, what are you thinking in terms of next steps for rescue?
Rescue, we're pretty well looked after. Got the rescue part of it, quote, rescue looked after. Now it's to start to meet the demands of the population to feed them, maybe clothe the ones who don't have clothes. Right now, food and then some shelter for the people who have. But where I'm walking in to start with right now, we got to find out when we're going to have shipping service fired up again out of Florida to Freeport. Air and ocean. I got to find out when the port's going to open, when the airport's opening, when, you know, and so on and so forth. Start with them and I'll be right there. I've been in communication with Coast Guard, Nassau, the government liaison officer, the lieutenant commander. They're looking after Abaco. So my personal main focus is Grand Bahama.
Well, you're clearly very busy, Eddie. I can hear that, and I don't want to take too much of your time. But I was just looking at a supply list published by the Bahamian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Things needed like 2,000 blankets, 500 porta potties. How will you be able to receive this material, though, if the airport is completely submerged?
We have a harbor here that we have tropical shipping sails here, Mediterranean shipping sails here, a small ferry out of Fort Lauderdale called Valeria sails here. We have plenty of ocean transport to make it happen. The air is only dire emergency. Get it here now. Food supplies, light stuff, you know, that you can put on an airplane.
What about drinking water? I mean, presumably a lot of the water right now is contaminated.
It could be. We haven't secured that information yet. But no, we have wells here that are fairly good. We might be okay in the water department. We feel like we will be. But again, I won't know that until I walk into this meeting right now.
Final question, Eddie. So many discouraging reports from people on the islands. Where are you finding hope right now?
We're a Christian community. We're a Christian nation. You know, we're very religious and God's our support. And it's, you know, by his grace that I'm even on this phone call with you right now, because I was out in some of that those conditions rescuing people personally. It is with his grace that we're going to follow and we're going to stick with it. His will is his will. What happened has happened. Now we have to move forward.
Eddie Wan, the chairman of the Bahamas Air and Sea and Rescue Association, on the ground in Grand Bahama. Eddie, a lot of people are thinking of you and your family and the people of the Bahamas. Thank you for sharing your time with us.
We appreciate you. Thanks so much. Call anytime.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Dorian is now sending dangerous storm surges up the east coast of the U.S. People in parts of Florida, Georgia, and the Carolinas have been warned of life-threatening storm surges in the next few days. Everyone stay safe. Today, Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, took to the airwaves and finally said the words that millions there wanted to hear.
The government will formally withdraw the bill.
The bill. That's the extradition bill that would have allowed people facing trial in Hong Kong to be tried in courts in mainland China. And though protesters wanted the bill to be withdrawn, it's something they demanded months ago. So doing it now?
Too little, too late, not good enough, no.
Too little, too late. That's the world's Patrick Nguyen, our reporter who's been in Hong Kong covering the protests. He says when it comes to appeasing the protesters, the bill isn't even a blip on their radar.
They have five core demands, and this is just one of them, getting rid of this bill.
The other demands? First, Carrie Lam, Hong Kong's chief executive, has to go. She might actually be okay with that. A leaked recording of Lam speaking privately revealed that she really, really wants to step down. But publicly, she says she's staying put. A second demand, the word riots. Not okay. But Carrie Lam says it doesn't really matter what they're called, legally at least.
We have explained that in fact there is no legal effect on how such incidents are described.
Third demand, all charges against protesters must be dropped. Lam says, sorry, that one is out of her hands.
It also goes against the basic law which states that criminal prosecutions must be handled by the Department of Justice, free from any interference.
And finally, one more big demand, one that the World's Patrick Wynn says is where protesters are putting all their energy.
Their main focus is on police brutality. They are really disgusted with the Hong Kong police force. They thought that they were a force that looked after Hong Kong people, and now they feel they've been co-opted. So they really want an independent investigation into police brutality, and that's what could actually send protesters back home and get them out of the streets.
Carrie Lam did say today that individual complaints against police have been handled, and there's going to be a fact-finding study on all of this. But a big independent investigation looking into police brutality, it's not happening, at least not right now. So the Hong Kong protests that have recently turned violent and destructive, people are telling Patrick Wynn those will continue.
They're going to be out this weekend. They are going to be going full throttle. They do not consider this to be any sort of concession.
So today's announcement that people in Hong Kong won't be extradited to Chinese courts, Wynn says the protest movement just isn't about that anymore. In fact, he says it might never have been about the bill in the first place.
If it wasn't this bill, it would have been something. There's this general angst in Hong Kong that it's being absorbed by China and that the rules of China will apply to Hong Kong. The rules of China are you can't say whatever you want. You can't go to whatever website that you want. And in Hong Kong, it's a more liberal, open, free society. And there's a general angst that's in the air that has exploded. And this bill was the match that set it off.
Set it off. There's no doubt about that. Okay, if you're a man and on the short side and you've got some French under your belt, the remote island of St. Helena may have a gig for you. The British territory is right in the middle of the South Atlantic, and it's looking for a Napoleon impersonator. Yeah, Bonaparte, not dynamite. We're talking French dictators here.
So Napoleon, his final exile was to St. Helena Island. It was in 1815 that he was exiled here, and he died here in 1821.
Justine Green works for St. Helena's tourism office. Next month, the island will kick off a series of events leading up to the bicentenary of Napoleon's death.
So we would be looking for an impersonator to dress as Napoleon, just to add a little flavor to the events that we're holding.
Yeah, I think it'll add a lot of flavor. I'm surprised, though, that there hasn't been on St. Helena a Napoleon impersonator before.
We did have one. The suit that we have is actually custom made to him. But unfortunately, him and his family relocated to the UK earlier this year. So that's why now we're looking for a new impersonator.
Who's going to be the ideal candidate for the job?
So we've been looking for somebody who is obviously interested in Napoleon, somebody who fits the suit, obviously, and is, you know, willing to play the role, really, just be willing to engage with the local community and our visitors at these events.
Have you gotten a lot of applications?
We've had quite a few, actually, from quite a few places in the world that we were not expecting at all. The advert went out locally. It got put on social media to try and get, you know, as much reach locally as possible. And it's gone international.
So, Justine, aside from playing dress up every day as Napoleon during this bicentennial, what are some of the benefits of living on the island of St. Helena? I mean, we think of islands as tropical paradises.
Yeah. We don't have white sandy beaches, but St. Helena is quite unique. We've got subtropical weather all year round. We've got some of the best whale shark diving around. It's just an incredible place. I know I'm a bit biased, but it really is.
So you've also got a Napoleon Museum in St. Helena. Is that a popular draw for tourists?
Yes, it is quite popular. It is actually his previous residence, well, his last residence on the island, Longwood House. We also have his tomb where he was first buried before they exhumed his body.
Right. He was exhumed and then taken back to Paris, right?
Yes, that's right.
Justine Green with the St. Helena Tourism Office. If you want to apply for the Napoleon impersonator gig, you've got until September 27th. Justine, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Many people expect refugees to be grateful for getting a fresh start in America, but what happens when they're not grateful? That's coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Immigrants are often expected to express thanks to their host country, and most do.
Now, thank God, I am very happy because I landed in America.
Just want to say thank you to all the American people that support us.
This is the first time in our life that we are welcomed, and you guys are so kind and nice.
When immigrants are critical of their new home, though, there can be outrage.
Ilhan Omar has an awful lot to be grateful for, but she isn't grateful, not at all.
But Dina Nayeri has some very different views. Nayeri was born in Iran and moved to the U.S. when she was 10. She says she took a risk naming her new book, The Ungrateful Refugee. That's because gratitude is complex for immigrants.
Every single refugee is absolutely full of it every single day. They feel gratitude toward every small moment. But it's a very private thing. And the thing that I wanted to argue against is the compelling of gratitude posturing toward the native born. Kind of this feeling that immigrants get that they should go through their lives constantly bowing, constantly showing their thanks to people who had really very little to do with their rescue. I think it's just this thing that happens, you know, slowly after arrival. People start to tell their stories in ways that feel a little bit like posturing, a little bit like theater, in order to show, you know, how lucky that they feel. And then they continue on, always holding their tongue when they want to participate, maybe in the political process. And as they go through their lives, they, you know, create this kind of theater, gratitude theater, assimilation theater. And it's not giving their real selves to their new lives, which would be what's best for them and for the people that are receiving them, or for everyone.
Dina, what is your own immigrant story? And when did you start to observe this burden of gratitude, as you put it in your book?
Well, I arrived from Iran after 2 years as a refugee. Those 2 years were spent in refugee camps and in hostels and various situations. I had been a smart academic kid from a respected family. They were doctors. We had very full lives. And I had expected, once this ordeal was over, once we were settled in a new place, to just find my place again in school, to have my mother find her place again as, you know, a doctor, and to be respected people in society again. But my mother had to work in a factory. She couldn't get her license back. There were language issues, and there was all of this hostility toward the Middle East. And I think people were a little bit afraid of us. And then when they learned that we were Christians who had found asylum in the States, they were more accepting. But they were always kind of wanting to hear our story in a certain way, you know, as in, we were rescued by America. We were so lucky. We had been so wrong before when we were Muslims, and then we found the right way.
Well, there's this moment,
there's
this moment not long after you arrive in Oklahoma, and there's a woman there who hears your story, and she sums it up by saying, oh, you came here for a better life. And you're miffed by that.
Yes. Our life in Iran was wonderful. We had a village that we would go to every weekend, full of orchards and hills, and we would hike and swim. And my family had been there for hundreds of years. We were happy because we were with our family and the people that we loved in a language in which we could communicate and we were respected. But then circumstances made us have to escape, and we ended up in Oklahoma, much, much poorer, in much more difficult circumstances. And so it felt very insulting to have somebody say, you must have come for a better life, because that meant that America by itself was better, that, you know, being a poor person in a tiny apartment in Oklahoma was better than being a doctor's child in Isfahan. And that's not the case.
To gain acceptance for asylum in the U.S., there are some pretty absurd requirements. And the asylum story, the actual narrative of why you need to be in the United States, really has to stand out. What details make for a successful asylum story, and how do these criteria differ between the United States versus, for example, the Netherlands?
You do need a story full of detail and full of particular kinds of memory. Now, the trouble is, a lot of people, when they escape, they don't store the kinds of memories that asylum officers want. Mm-hmm. Let's say you're in a car accident. Your car hits that pole, and suddenly you remember the bag of chips flying across the air and the way the oil from the chips smelled, because your sensors are so very on. But the part of you that is storing contextual information actually gets really, really weak in those moments of trauma. And that's why when asylum seekers go into their interviews, they often can't remember what day it was, what time of day, how long did it take for them to walk from here to there, what was the name of that person who was sitting there with them, etc. And that's the kind of information that the asylum officers most want. And they conduct the interview in these exhausting, like, 6-hour sessions in which they repeat the same questions again and again in, like, 20, 30-minute intervals in order to trip people up so that people will give a different answer to the same question down further in the interview. And the funny thing about that, too, is that when people are telling their story and they get asked the same question again, they think they've been misunderstood. They think they didn't say enough, and they will naturally say something very different.
So you're saying if you have like a Hollywood level storytelling ability or a photographic memory, it could save your life.
Exactly. The people who are most in need, the people who have left at the last minute, who have experienced trauma, who have experienced shame, who've maybe been tortured, those people will remember the least, will have the patchiest way of telling the stories, will have a lot of cultural shame, you know, and many of them won't have the kind of education that has taught them how to tell a story effectively or how to read another person from another culture and whether or not they're believing you.
I gather, and tell me if I've got this right, but you're actually uncomfortable with how many progressives in this country make a case for immigrants by talking about how they make America great.
Yeah.
Explain that.
It's complicated because immigrants do add to the economies that they join, and they are almost always looking to regain their profession, to work hard, to build their lives and family, and that is a truth. But the thing that I was saying is that I feel that it's incredibly disingenuous and incredibly selfish for people in settled countries to think, well, what do they give to us? You know, when people are in danger of losing their lives, of losing their families, of losing, you know, their homes, how can we sit here and wonder what they could give to us? What gives us that right? I use we as, you know, Westerners. We're born lucky. Even I was born lucky. I was born into a middle-class family, you know. So with that luck at birth, that accident of birth, having put us in this position of extreme privilege, we then look at the people in the countries that were, by the way, ravaged by our country's desire to gain their resources. We look at them and say, well, what can they possibly give to us? Or, you know, back to the question of economic migrant versus refugee. Have they suffered in exactly the right way? Are they being opportunists? You know, it's absurd to me, and it's really narcissistic.
And your idea that refugees need friendship, not salvation, does that kind of get at what you were just talking about? I mean, what do you mean by that?
I think so. I think all of it kind of has this central theme of trying to place ourselves kind of on equal footing. It's about dignity and about our respective place in a global society. So, for example, if a refugee is coming into your community and you really truly do see them as, you know, an equal human being who has had some really bad luck, you know, first of all, you're not going to mind them for their story so that you can feel better. Second of all, you're not going to put yourself on the perch of this charity giver and make them feel a lot worse about their situation. I think you would change your mindset and try to understand that actually this person wants to be more than anything useful. They want to be who they used to be. And so what can we do to bring them into our society and make them an equal part of it? I think I would really like for the native-born to think about what's going on in the psyche of these newcomers and what they might need and what they might need if they were in their shoes. And I think the biggest thing they would need, you know, aside from shelter and food and all of that, is love and dignity. They just want a friend.
Dina Nayeri's new book is The Ungrateful Refugee, What Immigrants Never Tell You. Dina, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
An Israeli comic joke that she'd like to marry the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. Some people took her seriously.
I went to sleep a very anonymous woman, and then I got up in the morning. Everywhere. It was everywhere.
I'm Marco Werman. The occupational hazards of a stand-up comic in the Middle East, still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. The U.S. and Iran have been at loggerheads for 40 years, but the last 16 months have seen some of the most intense confrontation. In May of last year, Donald Trump walked away from the Iran nuclear deal and launched a sanctions campaign of maximum pressure. The effects on Iran's economy have been crippling. Iran has responded with provocations that have helped bring the two countries to the brink of military action. But the Iranians may now be about to secure a financial lifeline. France is offering Iran a $15 billion loan. That's probably enough to help Iran hold out till after the U.S. election next year. Robin Wright is a senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace at the Woodrow Wilson Institute. Robin, why does France want to help Iran right now?
France has been involved in a quiet, behind-the-scenes set of diplomatic engagements with both the Trump administration and the Iranians to see if they can figure out a way both to get the nuclear negotiations back on track and, most importantly, to avoid some kind of military action. the Europeans in general are still committed to the original nuclear deal brokered by the world's six major powers in 2015.
And the idea is that $15 billion U.S. dollars from France will offset the pain of economic sanctions. I mean, that's going to go against economic sanctions then, right? Will the U.S. be happy with this move?
Well, the United States will not be happy, but it does come at a very interesting time. The French initiative is to try to get both President Trump and President Hassan Rouhani into a single room where they negotiate together and they agree to something bigger than the nuclear deal. But in the run-up to that meeting, both Iran and the United States are taking tough action. The United States has introduced a series of sanctions even over the past week. And the Iranians are saying they're going to move gradually away in specific steps from their commitments in the nuclear deal. But the goal of all sides in this big diplomatic game is to try to figure out a way to get beyond the tensions. And that could play out in 3 weeks when the UN General Assembly convenes in New York and the heads of state will be there. The Trump administration has repeatedly and quietly tried to get President Rouhani to meet in New York. The Iranians have always refused on grounds that they don't want a photo op. They want something substantial. And so you see this increasing pressure to try to get everybody together. Whether it'll work or backfire is hard to tell.
Well, we've seen what the White House means by summits with nuclear wannabes like North Korea. I mean, it's not terribly productive. What makes you think a U.S.-Iran summit would be any different?
Well, that's the big issue for the Iranians. And I met with the Iranian foreign minister in July in New York, and he repeatedly said, look, we don't want a photo op. Senator Rand Paul carried an invitation from President Trump to the foreign minister to go to the White House that very week to begin negotiations. And the foreign minister had to decide not to do it for fear that there wouldn't be anything substantive. And so I think the Iranians fear that it will be just a photo op that doesn't produce anything tangible, or if it does, it's another two-page statement that doesn't go very far when you consider the 2015 nuclear deal was 157 pages with very specific steps by all sides. And that's really what Iran wants at the end of the day, another very specific agreement that will alleviate its tensions and figure out a way to get beyond the current hostility.
What do you think the chances are of a summit between Hassan Rouhani and Donald Trump?
After 40 years of tension and attempts by seven presidents to try to end the tensions with Iran, it's very hard to see that this can end quickly. At the same time, President Trump has repeatedly said he wants to meet with the Iranian president. And I think the Iranians, they need now to figure out a way out of the economic squeeze they're experiencing. It can only get worse for them. The question is, how do you broker it? And I think there are some ideas out there. How do you move beyond the limits, the time limits on some of the elements of Iran's nuclear program? But how do you also deal with its missile program, its arrest of dual nationals and foreigners in Iran, its intervention and meddling in the Middle East, the things that President Trump wants to include in a broader deal about Iran's nuclear program?
Robin Wright, Iran scholar and writer with The New Yorker. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Meanwhile, in London, debate, vote, debate, a few calls for order. Will Britain leave the European Union? Will British lawmakers make that illegal? Are new elections coming? We're in for a few more days of parliamentary chaos in London before Parliament is suspended this weekend. But along the twisting, excruciating path that is Brexit, something else has happened in the UK. One of the world's oldest political parties, the Conservatives, is eroding from the inside out. Joining us to weigh in on this is Malcolm Rifkind. He's a former foreign secretary and a former Conservative member of Parliament. He's been a vocal critic of Boris Johnson's handling of Brexit. If you were still an MP, would you have voted against Boris Johnson yesterday? Would you be a victim of Johnson's purge right now?
Yes, I would have voted against the government, essentially because I think we are a parliamentary democracy and Parliament must have the last word, not the government.
One of the expelled MPs told the BBC that the Conservative Party has become the Brexit Party rebadged. I'm guessing that means rebranded. Do you agree with that?
Well, I agree with it as long as it's not misunderstood what that means. In the case of the Conservative Party, we have this massive division on Brexit, on the European Union. If and when that is resolved, even at this moment in time, there is no noticeable division within the Conservative Party on all the social issues that normally dominate the political debate, social and economic policy, foreign policy, defense policy. The Conservative Party and the government is extremely united.
But when the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, is expelling members because they don't vote his way, I mean, isn't that existential? I mean, that's a crisis.
Well, it is a crisis, but it's a different kind of crisis. It is not unacceptable in principle that if a government makes an issue a matter of confidence, if its own MPs or some of them do not vote with the government, then there are certainly precedents for the whip having been withdrawn. What makes it extremely foolish on this occasion is that we're not just talking about the odd individual. And of course, for the last 2 years, it was Mr. Johnson and his colleagues, many of whom are now in the cabinet, who were themselves defying three-line whips and voting against their own government on Brexit policy and were not penalized in this way.
Political parties do change over time. I mean, the Republicans in the U.S. Yep. used to be the party of Abraham Lincoln, of Teddy Roosevelt. Roosevelt bailed because it got too conservative. So do you accept that maybe a similar change is happening to the conservatives in the U.K.?
Do remember that our Conservative Party is the oldest political party in the world. And why has it survived? Because it's constantly changing to the changing needs of our society. If we were having this conversation 20 years ago, the Labour Party was totally hostile to the European Union, and the Conservative Party was strongly in favour. The Tory Party, the Conservative Party, has never really been ideological. Ideologies, socialism, communism, fascism, they come, they go, they disappear. The Conservative Party has been more about principles and values, and some people are worried that on the Brexit issue, the Conservative Party does sound ideological.
And as for these 21 members of the Rebel Alliance who went directly against their party's leader, Johnson, and his direct instructions and threats, do you see that act as one of political courage?
The way that they voted can only be admired. What they were doing was in the best traditions of democracy, regardless of whether you agree with it or not.
I have to ask, does it leave you wondering why Republicans in the U.S. have not done the same to President Trump?
Well, I do ask that question. I mean, I know the United States very well, and I have a lot of admiration for the Republican Party. But frankly, none of them, virtually none of them, wanted Mr. Trump or thought him as a suitable candidate to be president of the United States. And they've all caved in. Now, I can only speak personally. I'm very sad about it.
Malcolm Rifkin, former foreign secretary and former conservative member of parliament. Thank you very much, Sir Malcolm. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Let's flip the script now and talk science and outer space. To help us explore that, here's my colleague, Carol Hills.
Scientists have long been captivated by one of Jupiter's moons, Europa.
Europa is kind of the reason I get up in the morning, because I'm interested in the question of, is there life beyond Earth?
That's Georgia Tech astrobiologist Brittany Schmidt. She says this moon, hundreds of millions of miles away, is one of the places in our solar system where we're most likely to find life beyond Earth.
We're looking at Europa because it's the most Earth-like place I can think of in some interesting ways. And the reason for it is because it's one of the only places that has had geologic activity and an ocean over the history of the solar system.
Schmidt hopes one day to be able to explore the frozen over ocean on Europa to search for signs of life. But first, she's testing out the kind of equipment that might help her do that here on Earth. Our colleague Caitlin Sachs from NOVA interviewed Brittany Schmidt. Caitlin, you talked with her in a rather unlikely place.
Yes, about as close to Europa certainly as I will ever get. Brittany is testing a robot underneath the ice in Antarctica, and it really does feel like another planet. Her research site is a 45-minute snowmobile ride away from McMurdo Station, which is the largest U.S. research station on the continent. And it sits on sea ice. And so this frozen ocean shell is very similar to what we might find on other worlds in our solar system. And so this spot in Antarctica is a perfect playground to figure out how we'd even start to explore these icy moons.
Those moons, such as Europa, which is our main focus, are thick ice shells on top of a global ocean. And so we're interested in one day being able to explore those environments. In the meantime, we're trying to work here, kind of in our backyard, to figure some of this out.
I wouldn't exactly consider this backyard.
Well, when you think about Europa all day long, it's not so weird to think of Antarctica as your backyard.
So what is the work that Schmidt is doing in Antarctica that's going to eventually translate to this moon?
Her team has developed a robotic vehicle called Icefin. It's about 12 feet long, and it looks kind of like a torpedo, but it's loaded with scientific sensors. And what they do is they bring it onto the ice, drill a hole through that ice shell.
Okay, we're going to start going down slow.
And then launch it under the ice to explore underneath the ice there.
All right, we're clear of the hole.
And how thick is this ice that they're drilling through?
Right here, it's about 12 feet thick. On Europa, it will be much thicker. And what's remarkable about this mission is it really does kind of feel like a NASA mission.
All right, I'm ready for functional tests when you are.
They have mission control. It's a little tent right out there on the ice.
Go for test.
Members of the team are communicating over radios as they launch the robot.
Batteries are all at 100%.
Once it's launched, they pilot it using, of all things, a PlayStation controller. Over towards a nearby glacier.
We're swimming along the front of the glacier, getting an idea of the depth of the ice in front of us.
And explore the underside of that glacier.
And we're going to kind of follow this feature, staying under the sea ice. So there you go, you've got the light.
And what they're trying to do is find out what instruments are actually most useful for exploring this under ice environment.
We have forward analog camera, up down HD cameras. We have forward-looking
and make
sonar,
3D maps of these
CTD,
deep, tight, hard-to-reach spots that we couldn't get divers or boats to.
So in the case of Antarctica, where they're using it now, what have they been finding?
A lot of what this mission is about is just starting to figure out what technology works well and what doesn't for exploring such an environment. What information is useful to collect? What sensors would they want to load onto a robot that they'd then launch into outer space? But in addition to that, they're also learning more about the physics of ocean-ice interactions.
The physical processes are the same here in Antarctica as they would be on Europa. So coming to Antarctica gives us the physics that we need to improve our models of how Europa works.
It's interesting because the physical processes may be similar to Europa, but of course we can't do anything till we get this tool way up there. And how close are we to that?
Well, we are still a ways off. There is a mission launching in the mid-2020s called the Europa Clipper mission, and that will be a survey mission from orbit, which will tell us a lot more about the moon, and it would only be after that that we'd start talking about actually sending a mission to land on the moon and then drill under the ice and explore under the ocean there. So we're talking, it could be a few decades.
So I shouldn't hold my breath for news about aliens on Europa anytime soon.
Nope, not quite yet. But you can stay tuned for something else that actually might strike a bit closer to home. This coming season, in just a few weeks actually, Brittany is going to be heading back down to Antarctica, this time to the Thwaites Glacier. I know the world did a big series on Thwaites this past spring. This is a glacier that's at risk of catastrophically collapsing. It could trigger a rise in sea level of up to 11 feet. So now, Brittany is hoping Icefin can get to that spot where Thwaites Glacier lifts off the seabed and starts floating. So this is a very delicate and crucial point for that glacier.
That's incredible. So this tool, it's not just about Europa, millions of miles away up in the sky. It's using it to help us figure out Antarctica as well.
Exactly. If they can get it down there, it can make three-dimensional maps of the area down there and tell scientists about the physics of what's happening there. And that'll be able to tell us a lot about the stability of the glacier.
We're motivated in the long run by getting this data that'll send us into space. But there's important climate problems and really just unknowns about the Earth that we live in. And so by thinking about it like a spacecraft problem, you're actually able to see the Earth in kind of a new way.
So by using this tech that we're developing to eventually go to other worlds, we're able to get to these places where we wouldn't otherwise get to here on Earth and answer some pretty tricky questions about our own planet and its future.
Caitlin Sachs from NOVA. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The World's Carol Hills with our WGBH colleague Caitlin Sachs. Caitlin's reporting was supported by the National Science Foundation. Are there limits to comedy? Of course, but where those limits are depends on where you stand, literally. In Israel, a Jewish comic is using stand-up to talk about politics and identity in the Middle East. Her comedy crosses cultural, religious, and linguistic lines and limits. Naomi Zeveloff recently met up with her in her home village between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem.
Noam Schuster Eliassi cracks a joke as I open the door to her dusty blue car.
It's so nice I didn't have to do like my makeup because it's a radio interview.
We're on our way to a village known in Hebrew as Neve Shalom and in Arabic as Wahat As-Salam. Both translate as Oasis of Peace. It's the only village in Israel specifically designed for Israelis and Palestinians to live together. Noam is 32 and grew up there, and her unusual childhood is a big part of her comedy. Here's Noam at a show in London last year.
My grandmother couldn't understand that my mom intentionally moved to live with Arabs. So she walks into the house and slowly, and I'm like, Grandma, what's going on? She's like, close the door, there is Arabs outside.
We pass vineyards and a bright pink bougainvillea as we drive into Noam's hometown. We get out of the car, and a neighbor pulls up next to us. Noam speaks fluent Arabic. She learned it here at the bilingual school. She tells her neighbor that she's flying to Boston this week. Noam has a Harvard fellowship to develop her comedy into an hour-long show in Hebrew, English, and Arabic. She's calling it
Coexistence My Ass.
The title pokes fun at Noam's upbringing in this peace village and her years as an activist. After graduating from Brandeis University outside of Boston, she returned to Israel and worked for the peacebuilding group Interpeace. But Noam says she felt like she wasn't reaching people. So she began to do stand-up, telling jokes about Israelis and Palestinians, about her identity as the daughter of an Iranian-born Jew, and about her dating life.
You know, I care about the political causes, but I'm 31 and I'm single, so I go to demonstrations mainly to look for a date.
Noam says she doesn't just want to make people laugh. She wants to make them think. She also wants to challenge the power dynamics in the region. She recently appeared on an Arabic language TV show in Israel. She joked that she was looking for a husband and she's aiming high, the Saudi crown prince Mohammed bin Salman, MBS.
MBS. Marhaba. Ismi Naame.
The next day, the video was all over Arabic media. Some news anchors took her seriously.
I went to sleep a very anonymous woman, and then I got up in the morning everywhere, the entire like satire shows, news channels, like everywhere.
And there was a political subtext to the joke. The governments of Israel and Saudi Arabia are drawing closer. And Noam says it's happening at the expense of Palestinians.
There is no way in the world that we can solve, you know, the religious, the political conflict that we have here and the issues that we have here with Palestinians through going around over their heads, closing like narrow deals with, you know, with Saudi leaders.
Noam's political humor is popular with left-leaning Israelis, and it's also won her some Palestinian fans. We run into one of them in the village.
This is very straight.
Ahmad Muna is visiting from Jerusalem. He recognizes Noam from her videos and asks for a selfie with her. He says, as a Palestinian, he appreciates her take.
I can see someone on the Israeli side. An Israeli can actually see through what is Israel about and what is it really doing to the Palestinians from a very inside Israeli society funny point of view.
But sometimes there's a limit to Noam's reach with Palestinians. Last year, she was the first Jewish comedian to perform at a Palestinian comedy show in East Jerusalem. She was invited back this year, but at the last minute, her appearance was canceled. The organizer told her that politics got in the way. Noam decided to go to the festival anyway, as an audience member.
Now, please welcome your host, the founder of the festival, Amer Zahar.
Amer is a Palestinian-American comedian. He's the one who invited Noam. But he says this year the environment is too sensitive to bring an Israeli on stage. He lists a number of reasons. Among them, the fact that Israel just banned two U.S. congresswomen who support the Boycott Israel movement from entering the country on an official trip. One of them was Representative Rashida Tlaib, a Palestinian-American. Amer says comedy is about pushing boundaries, but there are limits.
We don't want to offend people, you know. We do want to push people to think and push people to expand their horizons a little bit. But that doesn't mean you want to offend the sensibilities of a whole. So we have to be, you know, careful.
Earlier on the way to the show, Noam told me she understands the sensitivities.
I don't want to avoid the reality. The reality sucks. You know, the Palestinians are living under occupation. We're not equals. But the Palestinian comedians invited me because they believe that there is something
to be done. So maybe it's not the right timing right now, and I still have to wait a bit, but it's a beginning of something.
A few days later, Noam leaves for the U.S. to develop her trilingual show. But even though she might find a more receptive crowd there for her sharply political humor, she's not planning to stay. She wants to bring her comedy back home. For The World, Naomi Zevaloff, Jerusalem.
At the center of comedy are words. Comedy is framed by language, but sometimes language itself can be a form of cultural resistance. The BBC's Victoria Stunt has this short story from Colombia.
Good morning. I'm from San Basilio de Palenque, says Andres Padilla Julio in Palenquero, the native language in the town 50 kilometers from Colombia's Caribbean coast. Andres is the leader of the rap group Combi La Salmi, which performs in Palenquero. Part of the group's mission, to use language, African instruments, and stories about San Basilio de Palenque to help preserve the town's traditions.
San Basilio de Palenque is declared a UNESCO Heritage Site for maintaining its music, language, orality, religion, gastronomy. With music, we want it to be maintained, to be shared.
People in San Basilio de Palenque have been discriminated against for speaking the language, says Andres.
When people hear Palenqueros speak, to them is poorly spoken Spanish because they don't understand it. A father or mother will say, don't speak the language, so they don't make fun of you.
But since the 80s in the town, there has been a push by residents to educate people about their ethnic roots. The Palenquero language began to be taught in the local school, and in 2010, the Native Languages Law passed in Colombia to protect languages like Palenquero.
The BBC's Victoria Stunt telling us about the revival of Palenquero in Colombia. Fewer than 8,000 people can speak some of the Spanish Creole-based language, so keep speaking it, keep it alive. And that's where we stop speaking today. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with more stories and news from around the world tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.